couple of ladies that lived together, and they were just so glad to see him when he came in, and they had him sit down and said, "Would you like some cake and coffee?" And he said, "Well, that'd be nice." And so they went out to the kitchen. Both of them hurried out to the kitchen to get him the cake and cookies, and he looked down, and there was a bowl of peanuts there. And he just started grazing on the peanuts, and like we do, he ate all the damn peanuts before they came back. And he was a little embarrassed by that, and he kind of pushed the bowl back under the edge of the table there so nobody would notice it. But they spotted it just when they came back. One of them said, "Oh, how nice you found the peanuts." And he said, "Yes," he said, "I'm really kind of embarrassed. I didn't intend to eat them all." And they said, "Oh, don't be embarrassed," he said. "They're no good to us, and we can't eat them at all. All we can do is suck the chocolate off of them." Different ages, you know, have different kind of problems. And he looked over on the piano, and there was a glass there with a condom in it. And he just couldn't quit looking at that. And finally he said, "You know, I'm just curious. What is that?" One of them said, "Well, we don't know for sure." She said, "We found it. And it said on the outside of it, 'Place on organ for prevention of disease.' And we didn't have an organ, but we put it on the piano, and do you know we haven't had a cold all winter long?" We don't always understand the solution either, you understand? I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with two college degrees, and I was, by most standards of the world, a successful man. I was a senior partner in the largest law firm in Dallas. I had achieved more professionally than I had ever thought possible for me. I had a nice home, and I had cars in the garage, and I had everything that, if you watch television or read the magazines, would say, "This is a guy, he's a successful guy." But I was a person who was ruined. I had no place to go and no solutions for my life. I was absolutely without any resources about how I could continue to live and function when I got here. I did not have any kind of spiritual life that I understood or knew. I prided myself on being intelligent, but my best thinking had led me to the point I was. In the next few years, I want to tell you what, I was not a spiritual being when I got here, I didn't think. I was sort of a hopeful agnostic. I hadn't found anything that worked for me in any form or fashion, ever. And I tried a lot of things. I'd really been trying to give it a pretty good effort, but nothing had ever worked for me. I was kind of a spiritual mongrel. I went from church to church and from book to book and from minister to minister, always trying to find something that would fit for me, and always having the same cynical, critical attitude, and always whoever it was selling it or whatever they were selling always flunked. And I kept plodding along. And when I got here and they told me this was a spiritual program, I can't tell you how disappointed I was, because that wasn't going to work for me. But after I've been here for a while, I came to understand that what we're talking about in the area of spiritual here is not religious. It is that part of life which is real but unseen. Real but unseen. There's a lot of things that are real but unseen. For example, you can't see love, can you? Most of us have experienced love in one form or another in our life. So it's a real thing. All of our feelings are real. We have to claim them. They're ours. They're facts in our life. There are a lot of things. Truth is real, but you can't see it. And what they're talking about in our book is in the area of spiritualism, is spiritual life, is a spiritual experience is defined. They, over in Appendix 2, they just define what a spiritual experience is. A spiritual awakening. It is a change in our personality sufficient to allow us to live comfortably and happily without alcohol or drugs. But that kind of change is not easy to do. It's not a decision. Did you ever make a decision how you were not going to be a certain way? I've decided a lot of times. I've told some girls that I'm changing my life. I ain't ever going to be that way again. Only to find I was that way again, right away, you know. It's not a decision. I've made a lot of decisions about my life. I've made decisions about emotions. I ain't ever going to be angry again. Only to get angry again. So it's more than that, just a decision that's involved here. These steps are deceptively simple things. You read them on the wall and they don't look like much. But when you apply them in your life, they bring about a prescribed result. They tell you what to do and they tell you what's going to happen when you do it. The book and the program doesn't care whether you believe it'll work or not. Really don't give a damn whether you believe it works or not. If you will just take the action. Take good faith, good spirit, just take the action that the book tells us to take, and the result will follow. And you will have the promises that are talked about in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It worked that way for me. I don't have them all the time. Life's always changing on me, but I have them a lot of the time. I think it's absolutely essential that you understand when you come here that nobody's going to fix you here. I came here to get fixed. I couldn't fix myself, and I knew something was wrong, and so I wanted you to fix me. I really wanted a shot of some kind, or a pill, or something, by God, that you could do to me. What were you going to do to me that brought about the result I needed? And you told me right away, you ain't going to do a damn thing to me. What you're going to do is show me what you did, and if I want to follow it, if I want to do it, then I'm in good stead. I'm in a good place. You see, the greatest thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is the principle of experience. When they wrote the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it was not a theory. And after they'd been doing it a while, they said, you know, we ought to write this down. We've learned some things from our experience. And experience is a really important thing. When I was a kid, I was raised out in West Texas on a farm out there near a little town called Bovina, Texas. My dad was a farmer, and we went to town once a week. And I'd see the town kids. And the town kids, I noticed one time, were riding bicycles. And I decided, hell, I'd like to have a bicycle. I never had ridden a bicycle. But it just looked to me like it was fun. And they got around real quick. And so I got to begging for a bicycle. And sooner or later, my dad finally agreed that he'd buy me a bicycle. And we ordered one from the Sears and Roebuck catalog. And it came in a crate in the mail, and we put it together and pumped up the tires, and Dad set it up and said, there it is. He had finished his job with the bicycle project, and he'd bought it and set it up, and it was mine to do with. And I didn't think there was any problem with that. I got on it to ride it. Never occurred to me that there was anything to learn about riding a bicycle. I saw it, nobody else ever seemed to be having any trouble riding them, and I just thought I'd just get on it and ride it, and I fell right over and busted my can. And I got up and I tried it again, and same result. And I went in the house and told my mother, I can't ride that bicycle. And she said, well, let me help you. So she went out there and she'd hold it up and trot alongside of me and turn me loose, and I'd fall over and bust my can again. Now, there are a lot of stickers out there on the ground in West Texas, and I'd had about all that bike riding I wanted pretty quick, you know, and in a couple days of dismal success. I mean, I was having no luck at all with this thing. I discovered a great truth. I had been sold a defective bicycle. Well, I had. There wasn't a damn soul in the world that could ride that bicycle. I had a bicycle that couldn't be ridden. And I told my mother that. I said, you know, ain't nobody can ride that bicycle. I'm not getting on that thing anymore. And she said, Jerry Jones, she said, you amaze me. She said, I have never ridden a bicycle over maybe once or twice in my entire life, but I could ride that bicycle. And I said, you could not. And she was a spunky little Irishman, and she went in the house and put on some slacks and came back out there and swung up on that bicycle and fell over and busted her can. I knew she was going to do it. I was even kind of glad she did it because I tried to warn her. She got right up and she got on it again. The next time, she just kind of wobbled off for maybe as far as from here to that door. Not very far. Not very pretty. But she rode the bicycle. An hour later, she just laid it on the ground, walked off, and an hour later, I was riding the bicycle. What man has done, man can do. What has been done before you can be done by you. Never been anybody that came to Alcoholics Anonymous that didn't have the opportunity to make this program work. If they have certain things, you got to have honesty. You don't have to have it all at once because we don't have much when we get here. But you got to be willing to become honest over some period of time with yourself, inside yourself, and with other people. You got to be willing. That means you got to go for it. You got to decide one time, I'm going for this damn thing. No holds barred. Win, lose, or draw, I'm going to try this thing. And you got to be open-minded. And that's kind of a tough one there. Because, you see, I was smarter than hell about most things. And I knew a lot. And when you started trying to tell me things about how I ought to do in life, I just didn't agree with you at all. But, you see, the fact is that you're not ever going to get well on your own terms. You're going to have to get well on somebody else's terms because, what? Our way didn't work. Our way did not work. We suffer from a disease. We know that's true today because the American Medical Association has told us it's so. They didn't learn that easily. When the book of Alcoholics Anonymous first came out, the American Medical Association did a little review on it. Let me read you what they said about that. They said, "This book is a curious combination of organized propaganda and religious exhortation. The one valid thing in the book is the record, just like the little doctor in the front of our book said we did. He said we had a twofold disease or illness that was made up, one part physical, which is an unusual reaction to alcohol. Now, I expect there are some people here tonight who got into some of those high-octane cigarettes and some of those pills that make you take off and go places even when you're here, and drank a little on top of it. And I expect some of you don't have a goose's idea what you're really addicted to, except maybe all of it. And that's just fine, because if for our purposes, that works just as well. I think that the fact is that something happens chemically to those of us who become addicted. And chemically what happens is there's some sort of reaction in our bodies that tells our brain, let's have another one of those. I believe I'm going to have one more of those. And then one more after that, and one more after that. And the first thing you know, we've had way too many of whatever it was we were having one of. And when we switch around, it doesn't change anything. We just pick up another one that it'll take one of those if that didn't work. And the first thing you know, we're back on one or the other of those. And the one we're talking about here is the one that the book was written about, which is alcohol. And alcohol, for sure, did that to me. The other thing, the other side of the disease is a thing called an obsession. An obsession is a big thought. It's so big it drives all the other thoughts out of your mind. And it's like the obsession I had was a drink will make it better. What is it? Anything. Anything. A drink would make this better. A wake, a wedding, a fancy ball, good day, bad day, you know, whatever the hell it was, a drink would make this better. And finally it got to where whatever I was doing was all planned around the drink. you know, let's have a few drinks and go to church. That seemed like a good idea to me, you know. Or let's go to church and then come back and have a few drinks. It doesn't matter. But somewhere there was going to be some boozing involved in this deal somewhere if I was going to play. I could find lots of reasons not to go to places where there wasn't going to be anything to drink. So whatever I did, I had that obsession. Now, I'm going to always have that obsession. Somewhere way down deep, in a way that'll never get any better, I'm going to be always physically addicted to alcohol and have always somewhere stored in my mind that a drink would make it better. On that farm that I was telling you about out there in West Texas, I had a dog. My dog's name was Patches. Patches was mostly an English bulldog. And I had a little event one time with Patches that tells the best story of alcoholism that I know. Patches was a hell of a dog. I mean, he pleased everybody. Everybody liked Patches. He was brave. He was a fighter. A week before this story I'm about to tell you, he went up in the field and got in a fight with a boar badger. He weighed about a pound more than the bulldog. We know that because after a couple hours fighting, the bulldog finally killed him. Now, to give you a little insight in his personality, every day for a week after that, he went up there in the field and picked up that dead carcass and shook hell out of it just to let him know that he was still around and still the boss. Now, in the morning I'm talking about, he didn't have any problems. He was a hero. He whipped the badger. Everybody loved him. He was well-fed. He had no competition of any kind on the farm. He had no problems. And a neighbor's boar hog got out. Now, boar hog is a little bit bigger than a boar badger. This one weighed about 600 pounds and had long yellow tusk and was just a mean sumbitch. And he came in our barnyard, and Patches got up from wherever he had no problems and went out there, and he made a decision to get hold of the hog. Now, when a bulldog makes that kind of decision, it's not a casual decision. I mean, it's serious business. And he went out there, and he got hold of the hog, and right away, a problem was created at our farm. The hog was squealing. The dog was barking. My dad heard that. He got out there, and he was cussing and kicking hogs and dogs. I saw what was happening to my dog, so I got out there. And I'm out there trying to get Dad to quit kicking my dog and the hog to leave him alone, and I'm out there in the middle of that. My mother sees me out there and knows her kid's going to get killed. So she gets out there, and everybody's in the middle of this damn brouhaha that's going on at the barnyard. And we all know the solution to the problem. Patches, turn loose the damned hog. Turn loose the hog. Well, he didn't turn loose, but he came loose after a while. And he got cut up. He got his throat cut. And he was bleeding real good. And we were able to catch him and hold him and pet him and slow him down and stop him and get him quiet, bandage him up a little bit, and put some medicine on him, turn him loose. He went right back and got hold of that damn hog again, right away. Same deal. Barking and squealing and cussing and kicking and crying and everybody wringing their hands and everybody knowing the solution to that problem. Hog knew the solution. We knew the solution was Patches, turn loose the damned hog. Well, we got him off one more time, and we recognize this time that Patches is not himself. Patches' intellect is being suppressed, and his emotions are just running wild. He's not operating with a full deck is another way to put that. And so we decided what we'll do is this time we'll commit Patches. He obviously can't control himself, so what we're going to do is we just tie him to the water hydrant for a while and run off the hog. Take the temptation out of his life. Let him sit there and think about his life. Ask himself some questions like, did you ever have any fun at all while you were a hold of a hog? Does anybody in your immediate family like or appreciate your interest in getting hold of hogs? And the answer is no. Did you ever get hurt with a hog? Every time he played with one, got hurt. You know, you just know he's going to think about that. And we gave him a couple of hours. And he got quiet. And he got that kind of silly grin that dogs get when they got their tongue hanging out, you know. And his little old stub of a tail was just beginning to work a little bit, you know. And I was watching him all the time. I was petting him and loving him and, you know, giving him unconditional love. And we turned him loose because he's obviously fixed. He had to go 2 miles to find the hog the next time, but he went back and got that damn hog one more time. Now, you see, everybody that's ever had anything to do with alcoholism can identify with one or more of the players in that deal. I knew who I was when I first thought of that story or remembered it. I was a Hogganon. Because we had the first Hogganon chapter out there in West Texas, I guess, trying to protect Patches from the hog and from himself. And then I became Patches, you know, because I got hold of something and everybody told me, Jerry, if you just turn that loose, if you just stop using that stuff, if you would drink a little different, you'd be a better husband, a better lawyer, a better man, a better employee, a better this, that, or the other. Everything would be better if you did that. And I thought that was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought that's why I'm coming here. I'm coming here so I can stop drinking and the rest of my life is going to be all right because I'm this successful guy, you know. But you see, getting hold of the hog wasn't Patch's real problem. That was just the way that it manifested itself. Oh, sure, he was in trouble when he was hold of the hog. But the real problem he had was what sent him out to get hold of the hog in the first place. And what sent him back again and again against undeniable facts that I'm going to get hurt if I get hold of that hog again. Now, it turned out not to be hogs at all, because Patches caught a cattle truck about a month after that, and he just caught one of those, and it was all over. But there's something in us that sends us back again and again and again, and that's what we're working on. And what we have to do in Alcoholics Anonymous is to recognize that our book doesn't tell us how to stop drinking or using or anything else. It tells us, it assumes we're going to do that. It assumes that we're willing to give it up. And what it tells us is how we go about. I didn't know what I had been missing. I liked the way they drank. I liked where they drank. I liked who they drank with. I could get just plumb excited on Monday of a week knowing I was going to get drunk on Friday night. It was just all week long I'd look forward to thinking about, God, we're going to get drunk Friday night. Ain't no telling in the world when we'll get home or what we will have done when we get there. I just thought that was marvelous. See, I was raised with some kind of peculiar ideas about myself. I put a lot of pressure on myself. I was always trying to be what you wanted me to be. But inside, I could never quite measure up to what I thought your expectations were of me. I wanted to be a man. But to me, being a man was kind of a twisted deal. You couldn't have any emotions when you were a man. You couldn't have any feelings. You could not feel fear. There were just a lot of things you couldn't do. You couldn't cry. And there were times when I cried, and there were times when I feared. And I just had to learn to live in ways in spite of that. I remember going out for football in the 8th grade. High school coach came through the 8th grade, and he looked over the boys in the class, and he picked out, I think, 4 or 5 of us in the 8th grade that he said could go out for spring football with the high school football team. And I happened to be one. He saw I was about as tall as I am now, and he figured I was going to put some muscles on somewhere. It never happened, but he thought it was going to. And so he invited me out to play football. I didn't know how to play football. I'd come from a little old country school. I mean, really a country school. This was country, but that was really country, where they wouldn't even let you bring a football to school for fear somebody would get hurt. But girls like football, and I like girls. And so I decided, hell, I'll just get into this football business. And I went in there, and they showed me how to put on that uniform to keep yourself from getting hurt. You know, that's why you put it on. And we went out to play football. And we ran for a hell of a long time. Did a whole bunch of exercises that I never had done before. And then we started a thing called scrimmage, where they began to knock the bejeebies out of me every time I turned around, you know. It was just field. I spent half the day getting up and the other half, you know, hurting from getting knocked down. And in about 2 hours of that, I had all the football I ever wanted. I got a lifetime supply of football in one afternoon. We went inside, and it took me a long time to figure out how to get out of that contraption. And I'll just tell you, if you've never done this, they don't help keep you from getting hurt a damn bit. Matter of fact, those helmets and things kind of hurt you themselves sometimes. Anyway, I was getting out of this, and I was just going to get ready to tell the coach I was quitting. I didn't want to play. And two guys that were in my class walked out just ahead of me and handed their equipment in and said to coach they wouldn't be back. And then they began to talk about guys having yellow stripes down their back. Some had it, some didn't. And then they turned around to me and they said, Jones, how'd you like football? I said, I've been wanting to play football all my life.
I like football.
That's the way I live my life. That's the way I live my life. And when I got to the point where I could take a drink and had a few drinks, it chemically altered things. It made me not care. I liked not caring. To hell with them. I can't tell you the number of times I got drunk with just those thoughts before I had the first drink. To hell with them. Screw them all except six, and we'll save them for pallbearers. That was, you know, not going to be my attitude, and that's just the way I love to drink. And I wasn't ever going to give that up. Was not going to give that up. And I hung on to that just as long as I could. Thank you. I hung on to it through a lot of success, like I said. I hung on to it through a lot of my life until I reached the point where my wife went to Al-Anon one time. And I was, by that time, this senior partner in this law firm, thought a lot of myself. You know, I was real proud of myself, thought I was a big-timer. And it's all I had, you know. It sat with me and talked to me 10 minutes, and I would tell you how many cars I had, how much money I had in the bank, what kind of position I had. That's all I had, you see. I was always trying to keep the front up so you wouldn't really find out who I was on the inside. They called them. And I knew what they were talking about doing to them. They're going to get rid of them just as quick as they could. That's what they were going to do. And they were even more powerful people than I was. So I knew what they were going to do when they found out about me. And my wife, the first thing she ever told me about Al-Anon was that anybody can go. Anybody can go. All you got to do is know somebody's got a drinking problem, and you're welcome in Al-Anon. That's a public meeting. My wife is going to public meetings and discussing my problems with people I don't even know who they are. And there's literally thousands of people in this world that don't need to know I've got a problem with alcohol. Like all the judges, all the lawyers in town, all their families, all the witnesses in my cases, my clients. God, there's thousands of people. If they see my wife in Al-Anon, sooner or later my partner's going to find out about it. We're fired. When I'm fired, the money stops. I'm the only one in that damn family that'll work for a living. The money stops. The house goes. The cars go. We're on the street. Now, we're not talking about not sending kids to college. We're talking about not eating now. And I explained this all to my wife real carefully. Just drew word diagrams, A, B, and C. And asked her, please, not to go. And she said, I need to go. And I said, you can't go. And she said, I'm going. I said, I'll kill you if you go. She said, I'm going. And she went. And I could never leave it alone. I was after her all the time. All the time trying to get her to get out of that damn thing called Al-Anon. And she hung in there. They'd had her too long when I got hold of her. You know, they'd brainwashed her bad. She had somebody she was always calling and talking about our fights and things. And it was a hell of a mess around there. She'd make a list of things, and there was AA literature. And I'm telling you, there's more AA literature in my house laying around loose than you ever saw. And I couldn't leave it alone. I just couldn't leave her alone. I was obsessed with the idea of getting her out of Al-Anon. And I kept just needling her and fighting her and everything, you know. And I'd pick fights. I'd decide to pick a fight. I'd come in feeling pretty good and have a couple of drinks and decide I'll just, by God, pick a fight. And the way I do that is, you see, I sneak up on them. I walk in real cool and I say, you know, ask a couple of questions that I need an answer to so I can use in my argument. And then I get serious about fighting. And this one night, when it was going to start real easy, I said, Billy, I've been thinking. You believe I'm an alcoholic, don't you? Easy answer, huh? She said, I don't know whether you are or not. I said, you've called me an alcoholic 1,000 times. And she said, yes, but I was wrong. We ain't getting much going here, you know. And it kind of got me off balance, you know. She said, it don't matter what I think. It does not matter a whit what I think. It doesn't matter what the partners in your law firm think, the doctors think. It doesn't matter what anybody in the world thinks except you. You got to know whether you are or you are not. Because if you think you are, you may do something about it. If you think you're not, you'll never do a damn thing. And then I made a mistake that no good lawyer ever makes. I asked a question when I didn't have a goose's idea what the answer was. I said, well, if I wanted to find out if I was an alcoholic, how would I do it? Oh, my friends. They have an answer that is just, see, I had asked this damn information. It wasn't as though they forced it on me. It wasn't like all them pamphlets that she was giving me. I asked for this information. And she said, the answer to your question is you should try some controlled drinking. And by that I mean you should drink 2 drinks a day, every day, for 6 months. No more, no less. And if you can do that and never exceed that amount, you're not an alcoholic. I believe that because a lady named Marty Mann wrote a book called The Primer on Alcoholism. She was the first woman in AA or some such thing as that. And I believe if you can do that, you're not an alcoholic. If I was ever going to get that damn woman out of Al-Anon, I was going to have to pass that test. And somebody was going to have to make a sacrifice for our family and my profession, and it was going to have to be me, it looked like. And I'd been meaning to cut back a little. I mean, I realized I drank a little more than most people. Most days I drank, I had a couple drinks at lunch some days, and then when I got home, I got serious about it. I drank about half a fifth of Beef Eater's gin before dinner. And then I had something to eat, and then I drank another half of a fifth or half quart of brandy after dinner. And I didn't know anybody in the world that drank that way. I had lots of blackouts. I thought everybody drank like I did. But I thought I was drinking the amount I wanted to drink. If you'd asked me, why do you drink that way? And I'd say, because that's just the kind of guy I am. I just like to drink. That's my style. I didn't mind being thought of as a heavy drinker. A lover and a fighter and a wild horse rider, all that stuff, that just fit right into my plan, you know. But this 2-drink-a-day deal, I decided, well, I'll do it. I didn't tell her I'm going to do it. Didn't tell anybody in the world that I'm going to take the test. Had to change the test just a little. Wait a minute, you don't understand. 2 drinks don't do anything for me. But I had a pretty good-sized glass, and I figured 3 drinks. I'd have 2 big martinis before dinner, and then I'd have a big brandy after dinner, and nobody in the world could fault me for drinking that way, could they? My God, no, they couldn't. And they wouldn't have, except when I started doing that, I ran across a really interesting phenomenon. I would have 2 of those drinks. I'd get about halfway through the last one, and I'd think, well, it's about all the martinis today. And then it would happen. A stray thought would come in from way out in left field, and it'd say something like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Are you over 21? Are you a man? Who pays the mortgage on this damn house and supports everybody in it? Who works like hell every day? Are you going to let a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes tell you how to drink whiskey? And the answer was always the same thing, hell no. And I got up and went to the bar, and I drank the bottle. Another thing would happen. I'd go to the bar for the first of those drinks. And I'd get to the bar, and I'd think, God, I had a bad day. The sons of bitches were really after me today, weren't they? I just don't believe I'm going to take that damn test today. And so, that day, I drank what I wanted to drink, and I drank the bottle. I had another thing I could do, and it was damned important to me. I'm kind of making it funny now, but it was important to me to get my wife out of that damn thing called Al-Anon. Really was important. And I could forget to take the test for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. Just forget it. Get busy with my problems and just never think about it. But every time I knew I had taken it and remembered it, it was in the morning when I first awakened, hungover, and wondering why did you drink like that? You made a decision, a grown man made a decision that you were not going to drink but 3 drinks last night. Why did you drink more than that? And I never had an answer for that. I couldn't blame anybody in the world for that. Now, I didn't give this test any little old short run either. I worked on that test about a year and a half. And I don't believe I ever passed it one time. I didn't always get knee-walking drunk, but I always drank more than three drinks. And many, many nights I drank to the point where it caused a problem in my family and my life. I answered a telephone call when I'd had too much to drink. Client talked to me. Clients were beginning to ask me, "You really like that boozing, don't you?" And it was closing in on me. My world was closing in on me. And the more I flunked that test, the more I thought about this crazy damn thing that was going on in me and couldn't understand it. And I wound up just thinking about whiskey all the time. Wishing I had a drink, wishing I didn't have a drink, wondering if I had enough. Just thinking about booze all the time. I knew something had me. At the end of that year and a half, whatever it was clear that I wasn't in control of alcohol. I couldn't take a drink and quit. Taught people some songs, Christmas songs that I learned in the Navy that they never had heard before. I was the only one at the Sunday school party drinking. It was in my house. I offered them all a drink. Nobody would have a drink. My wife said it was a bad scene. Yeah, I'm sure it was. I got drunk and insisted on driving my car after I was drunk on LBJ out here. Nothing scares a drunk in the world worse than having a sober person drive their car. And I drove mine at 35 miles an hour around rush hour traffic around LBJ drunk with my wife in the front seat, and she was pretty nervous by the time we got home. I'd had a lot of bad experiences. December the 31st, I needed to go out New Year's Eve, and I needed to bring it in right. I needed a new year because I'd just worn the hell out of the old one. I needed to get something off to a right kind of start. And it was important that I at least make a good showing. I needed to last until midnight. Now, that's not much of a goal in life, is it? And we made arrangements for me to stay home. We were going to go out and eat, and then we were going to come back, and I could party at home. And we had one set of friends that were coming over. And I remember waking up. I started drinking a little early in the day, just kind of ease the day along, you know, had football games to watch. And it was dark outside, and my wife was sitting there in her robe, and I said, shouldn't you be getting dressed for dinner? She said, "Oh, Jerry, don't you know what time it is?" And I looked at my watch, and it's 10 o'clock at night. The last time I remember looking at my watch, it was 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I passed out 5 o'clock in the afternoon when I needed to last at 12 o'clock. And I was sick of me. I was just sick of what I was and what I wasn't. And I didn't have any excuses. And I didn't have anybody to blame. And I got up and had another drink and I went to bed. That turned out to be the last drink I've had until today. And I pray it's the last one I ever have. I got up the next morning and told my wife that I was going to quit drinking if I could, because I wasn't sure at all that I could do that. She said, "Would you like for me to call somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I said, "Hell no. Hell no." And she said, "Here's a copy of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous and a little 24-hour book." I don't know why she happened to have those there, but she had them. And very graciously, I threw them against the wall, pretty close to her head. And I said, "Let me tell you something, lady. You keep the damn literature and the AAs and the kids and the dogs and yourself the hell away from me. Because I got myself in this mess, and if anybody's going to get me out, it's going to be me." And she said something like, "You got it." And I had it. And I really did have it. I had it. I didn't know it. And I began to try to not drink. And I began to experience that terrible thing called sobriety. I began to experience the feeling of needing a drink terribly bad, not being able to sleep, having those shakes on the inside and the outside, the yippies. Did you have the yippies? That's when you get real quick. You look different places real quick like I did, you know. And I couldn't be in the right spot. And if I was sitting down, I need to be standing up. If I was standing up, I need to be outside or inside or walking. I couldn't stop anywhere. And I walked the streets and I looked at people. And I knew that they were functioning. They were happy. They were laughing. They were going places, doing things. And I wasn't doing anything but wanting a drink. And I began to realize that this ain't going to be easy for me. So I decided I'd sneak in the house and got that little 24-hour day book and take a look at it. I got the little 24-hour day book because it was little and it was quick, and I didn't want my wife to catch me reading that big book. And I'm sorry the big book was conference approved, and the little book was not, but I didn't know about that then. And I read the quickest thing I could get my hands on. I opened it up, and with this keen alcoholic mind, I noticed there was a date in the upper right-hand corner. And I found January the 2nd, and it described me to a T. It talked about how I was disgusted with myself and the way I drank. Talked about how my life wasn't doing any good, how my life was going downhill, was unmanageable. I'm going to give you this drinking problem. And if you take it, I may do some more business with you. It turned out to be as good a prayer as I've ever said. Because the next day, I needed some help. I knew I needed some help. You just know it. I knew I wasn't going to be able to stay sober by myself without it. And I needed some help with skin on it, some people. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I began to do this program, not too willingly in the beginning, but regularly at least. And it led me into the process of recognizing my powerlessness over alcohol. I had a problem. The ball's always in your court in Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you ever notice that? We never get around to straighten out the sons of bitches. It's always in my court. They're always talking about me. I waited for them to tell them, give me a chance to have one night when we were going to discuss my wife or something. And every time I start talking about them, they said, we're just going to solve the problem of people that are in the room here. Your wife ain't here. We're going to talk about you. So I had to start talking about me and looking at me. And yeah, I was powerless over alcohol. And yeah, I had some problems. And yeah, I didn't like you in the beginning. I didn't like anything about you. I didn't like the way you hugged each other and patted each other. You weren't hugging me, by God. I stayed away from you. Drank coffee at all hours of the day and night. I wasn't sleeping any. Why in hell would I want to drink coffee? You know, I wanted to go to sleep. And I had the yippies still, and I did, you know, just, and they did goofy things. People stand up there and talk about the damnedest things I ever heard in my life. Some guy tell the worst things he ever did in his life. Had 42 convulsions, in jail 200 times, divorced 18 times, left women and kids all over the world, and they're laughing like hell, you know, while all this is going on. And I got to thinking, hell, I did a couple of things that are kind of cute. Maybe I ought to tell them. I'm competitive if I'm nothing else. So I picked my time, and I told them one of my things, you know. And they laughed like hell, and they put their arms around me, and they said, look at this. Look at this. Jerry is becoming himself. He's becoming himself. That's all you're ever going to be. That's all you're ever going to be. That's all you can be, is who you are. Today, right now, where you are is all you can be. You have to start here. You have to start now, and you have to start being you. And you're better than you ever thought you were. And you can't be so screwed up. You can't do anything to yourself that you screw yourself up forever. There's a part of you that can't be messed up. And that's the part you're going to find in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's where we start. That's what we're looking for. Be yourself. Act inside your own values. Do what you know is right. And be true to that, and be yourself, and it begins to get some better. It took the pressure off of me. I got to where I could say my name, that I was an alcoholic, without it sticking in my throat. I even got to where I could listen in discussion meetings before they called on me. When I first started, I had to spend all my time thinking what I was going to say, and I never heard a damn word until after I'd got to talk. And then, after I'd made a big impression on everybody, I could listen to some of the other folks. And I got a damn sponsor. And he began to meddle around in my life and tell me other things I had to do. But more importantly than anything else, I came to believe, which was the second step. I came to believe there's something working here. Have you seen it? Have you seen it working here? Look at it. Look at the people and listen to them. You see, you know, people now here are not talking about the kind of things they talk about in the clubs. They're talking about real things. They talk about the way they feel. They talk about caring for you. They're interested in you. They want you to call them. They ask you how you are, and they really want to know, how are you? How do you feel? How do you feel? Hell, I didn't know how I felt. I know I had feelings. If I wasn't sick at my stomach, I said I felt fine. Because I didn't know about anything else. But you kept prying and probing and working on those things. And I began to watch people in this program. And I started reading it, and I read a couple of pages, and I thought, well, you know, they haven't said anything that's too off the wall yet. They haven't talked about anybody walking on water or anything like that that I have a little trouble with. I'll read another page or two, and then I began to read a little more, and I got just absolutely excited. And I got to thinking then, God, I hope they don't hook me in that last two or three pages and tell me something I can't believe. Hope they don't tell me I have to do this thing on to get faith. I hope they don't tell me I got to get faith. Did you ever try to get faith? Did you ever try to just have faith? They always told me in church, have faith, Jerry. Have faith. And everything will work out wonderfully. And I've sat in a chair and decided, okay, by God, I'm going to have faith. Ain't got it yet. I'm not trying hard enough. Not going to ever ask another question in my life. I'm just going to believe everything they tell me. Don't believe that. Do not believe that. Decided finally, you know, sometime in my life that I'm going to have to go down to the front to be saved, and then it's going to be all right. Then I'll have faith, and then I'll believe. And I went down to the front. And grown men cried, and it was just wonderful. Everybody came up and hugged me, and they were wonderful, good people. And they were happy for me. And they said, don't you feel different, Jerry? And you know what I told them, don't you? Oh, yeah. Yeah. I did. I was more disappointed than I've ever been in my life because nothing happened to me. I felt different, but I felt wrong different. I felt everybody, finally, I began to judge them. And I noticed they did the same kind of things I did. Things that I thought they were saying was a sin. And I decided the church was full of hypocrites. And I just became skeptical about that. But I decided finally that I would give this thing one more go. That I would try to believe. And the book says some important things about this. It says you've got to be willing to believe. I think I was willing to become willing to believe. Then it says you start with what you do believe in. Hey, that's something new, isn't it? I don't have to believe anything. I remember asking them, what do I have to believe in Alcoholics Anonymous? Virgin birth, walking on water. What I got to believe? Tell me what I got to believe. Let's get this over with to see whether I can do this thing or not. And they said, believe anything you want to. I remember one damn fool told me, he said, you can believe your higher power is the Coke machine if you want to. I said, what the hell are you talking about? He said, well, you put in money at the top and Coke comes out the bottom. It's kind of a miracle, ain't it? He told me he didn't think that would satisfy me very long, but I could start there. And you start with what you can believe. They even sent me out to make a list of the things I believed in and a list that I did not believe in. And when I came back with my little short list of what I could believe in and my real long list of things I didn't believe in, they said, keep the little short list and throw the real long list away. Because what you don't believe has always kept you from acting on your beliefs. You've been stuck in no man's land where you could neither believe nor disbelieve. And when I read the chapter to the agnostic, those were things, you know, I could believe some of that. And they told me to begin to build on that, to begin to look at my life, begin to take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life and apply them as best I could to the everyday things that happened to me. And that if I did these things, at the end of that deal, I would have a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience. And I would believe in this power based on not what you told me or they told me, but my own experience. It's worked that way for me. I've had some interesting things happen to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. You're all the time. You're lost. And anyway, I was looking. And I went out to East Texas and I went to this little retreat given by a guy named, I can't remember his name right now. And He'd written a book called The Beginners that I liked very much. Talked about always being a beginner, being willing and open-minded and willing to learn. And I went out there with my wife, and there weren't but about 20 people, I guess. There may be 10 couples. None of them in AA except me. And I was kind of uncomfortable. And I was sitting there in this little room the first night, and he walked in, he said, okay, let's get this thing started off right. He said, let's everybody go around the room and tell what God's doing in your life today. Well, let me tell you, there's a couple things in life that I really didn't like at all, And one of them was testimonials. I can't sit still for testimonials. People standing up talking about what God's doing in their life just drove me crazy. Praying was another thing I couldn't. If they asked me to pray, I didn't. I was uncomfortable about praying. Just some of those things that bothered me. And this was one that did. And I needed to leave the room, and I was all the way across the room from the damn door. It was going to be obvious if I got up and walked out. I told my wife I was going to go out there and listen to this guy. So I decided, well, I'll sit here and somebody will say, I pass. I don't want to do this. Or no thank you, I don't believe to share, or something. And the problem was they all began to do it, every damn one of them. And you know, if you haven't ever talked to any of these civilians, you don't really realize what wimpy little old problems they got. I got to sit and listen to them going around, and you never heard anything like it. One of them couldn't raise their kids without God. Another one couldn't drive Central Expressway every day without God. Another one couldn't run his business without God. I've been doing all them things all the time without God. You know, that ain't no big deal. And I got thinking, you know, here I've been sober, though, for 4 or 5 months. I haven't had a drink of whiskey for 4 or 5 months because I said that little old prayer on January the 2nd. I've been going to them damn meetings with those people and not drinking. You know, giving up every damn thing that's worthwhile in my life. But I haven't done it. And I guess it's because that power's working. And if I told those Baptists they had a real alcoholic right in their very midst, who hadn't had a drink for that period of time, they would be impressed. Blow the socks off the Baptists is what I do. If I told them that. I really ought to tell them. I'll probably never see another one of them again as long as I live. I might just well tell them. So I decided I'll tell them. When it comes my time, by God, I'll just really give them something to think about. I'll tell them. And then I don't remember what anybody said for a while because I was rehearsing my speech. I didn't hear them talk for a while. But there was a big old boy and his wife sitting right next to me, and then my wife was over here, and he came to him, and he got up, and he did the worst thing you ever saw in your life. He got up and began to bubble around and cry. Couldn't talk. And that got my attention. I felt so sorry for his wife, I couldn't understand it, you know. Pretty thing, married to a big old bubbling, wimpy guy like that. And then she got up. And she was a pretty thing. She had pretty calm eyes. She had a little smile on her face. It was just kind of easy. And she stood there relaxed and comfortable. And she said something like, I don't know what I'd do without this power. I just don't know what I'd do without this power. She said, I got two little kids. They're ages 2 and 3. And it's so nice to know that they can have the power too, even if I'm not here to teach them about it. And it's nice to know that my husband's got the rest of his life to live, and he didn't have to have me. He can have the power and go on with his life. And he's got a good policy of insurance so that he won't be crippled financially by my last illness. And I recognized that I was listening to a young woman talk about dying. Not a long time off. She was supposed to die in a couple of months. She had cancer. An incurable disease. I had an incurable disease. Mine was called alcoholism. Hers was called cancer.